So good afternoon, everyone, on karma and rebirth in early Buddhism. And Ajahn Brahmani and myself will be taking some time today to review what we've done in the course and also giving a chance for some more discussion and questions, and especially things which you feel were unanswered or which you think you'd like to see looked at in more detail from the course, then now is the time to do that. So just we won't formally start until a few more people coming in. Just to let you know, I just came back from Indonesia, where I was at the Sakyadita conference, Women in Buddhism conference, and there were a lot of Buddhist women there. Yes. None from here, how come? Because, well, that was very bad. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, you should have gone next time. And they want to do one here in Perth. And I spoke to the organizers. They said, do you think we can do one in Perth? I said, well, we've got this conference coming up later in the year. So when the organizers of the conference have finished with their post-traumatic stress therapy in 2 or 3 years' time, then Oh dear. Anyway, but 1,000 people from all over the world. I mean, it's an incredibly diverse conference. It was really amazing, actually. And to get them all to Yogyakarta, it was quite something. One of the memorable events, they had a panel on LGBTQQIA, I think. We put A at the end to stand for aliens. I think you have to put that in there now. And people with different sexualities and so on. And interestingly enough, that was the same afternoon that the Supreme Court in the US passed the law making same-sex marriage legal in all states of America. So obviously there was some kind of karmic influence there that tipped the scales. So we were very happy to see that. And it's interesting, when I mentioned that in the conference, I had a panel the next day as it happened, and I mentioned that. And, we're doing a conference in Indonesia, which is not somewhere that's known for sort of progressive policies on those kinds of matters. And when I mentioned it, there was a spontaneous applause from the whole audience. And so, it's quite amazing. So, and got to see a lot of my old friends. To see the energy and enthusiasm for Buddhist practice among so many women from so many different places was very inspiring. Okay, so for this workshop today, what we're going to do is we'll go through the revising the course, and we'll sum up each section of the course in turn, and we'll use that as a chance for discussing issues that might be relevant for that. And we have a few interesting things coming up. In particular, we had some more feedback. You probably remember that on the workshop for the evidence for karma and rebirth, we had Venerable Chaga talking about his experience under hypnotic regression. Well, since then, he's done some more regression, which came up with very interesting results. And we've also had the good opportunity, one of my students in Sydney, Barbara, has done some research into that, and she actually went back and checked up all the historical records and the names and dates and places and so on. So that was very interesting, and we'll be giving that a little bit later on. Even this is very cutting edge. Even Venerable Chaga doesn't know about that yet. I haven't been back to Bodhinyana since. So let's start with the first workshop. And Venerable Brahmani, please. Ah, wireless microphone doesn't work.
Ah, okay.
Very good.
Okay. Always lots of tech dukkha here. So this is fine. Okay, so we're going to start off with the first session, as you may recall, which was all about myth-busting. That was the first time we started off with that because it was deliberately slightly provocative and therefore perhaps interesting for that reason. So we looked at various myths in Buddhism in regard to karma and rebirth, obviously. And then we had a look at whether they were reasonable, whether these were actually myths that were just myths or whether they had some kind of truth to them or not. And what I thought we could do now is just to review some of those myths, have a look at some of the maybe perhaps most important ones. Obviously, what is important to people is going to vary, but at least perhaps some of those that stood out and were, at least for my personal reckoning, quite important. And one of those myths that you hear a lot in, especially, this is of course obviously very significant in terms of karma and rebirth, this idea that the Buddha took on the ideas of karma and rebirth as part of a cultural package that inherited from Indian society, right? So you believe in these things or you even propagate them in your own teaching because you have accepted them as part of the what the rest of society teaches. And, of course, the reality when you start reading the suttas in detail and you know what's in there is that there is no basis for this whatsoever. In fact, it is the exact opposite that comes out of the suttas. The Buddha specifically said that he looked into the various types of teachings that were available in India at the time. Karma and rebirth was only one of those teachings. Other teachings were teachings of were materialistic in the sense of when you die, everything comes to an end, just like materialistic teachings in the present day. They existed also at the time of the Buddha. So the Buddha obviously knew about these things, and he actually talks about these teachings in the suttas. So that is the first reason why that theory obviously doesn't work. Another one is obviously that the Buddha was somebody who was a kind of a radical inquirer, if you like. He inquired into everything. He went even so far as to inquire into the existence of a self, right? The non-self idea. And of course, the idea of non-self is a far, far, far more radical teaching than rejecting or accepting rebirth could ever be. So he was a radical inquirer. He inquired into all these things. It just doesn't fit with the Buddha as a person, the way his personality comes across, the way he did things, doesn't fit at all with the idea of somebody just accepting something on faith or out of confidence in the culture at the time. And of course, then there is other things, we can come back to those later on, how the ideas of karma and rebirth integrate into Indian society, into the Buddhist scriptures. They're very kind of holistically part of that, and it doesn't make any sense even to pull those out of the Buddhist scriptures. You basically lose the essence of the Buddhist teachings by pulling those out, and the whole thing becomes incoherent and really very, very implausible. So that was the first one, and this is actually a very important one because it's an argument you hear all the time, the idea that the Buddha used it either metaphorically, which is a little bit similar to this, or he just accepted it as part of the cultural heritage. That obviously there was some cultural heritage. Everybody, we all form by the society around us. And so, of course, there is some truth to the general idea that everybody has a cultural heritage. But in this particular case, it obviously doesn't work at all, basically. I find it a very, very implausible thing. And I cannot see how people can actually argue this point, especially if they have read the early Buddhist texts, which we're talking about here, read it in full and seen the context for all these things. So that was the first one. I've made a few notes here of some of the ones I thought were interesting because there were so many of these myth bustings, myths to be busted. And another one that we talked about, which I also think is very significant, and it kind of changes the whole landscape, how we view Buddhism, how we view the idea of karma, is this idea that you will often feel everything we do, everything we feel. Karma is basically about experience, right? The result of karma is about experiencing pain or pleasure. And according to this idea, everything we experience is the result of karma. This is one of those kind of standard things that people will often ask questions. Why am I, you know, why is this happening to me? Why am I, is my wife or my husband divorcing me? Why are my children naughty? What have I done in the past for this to happen to me? And this is the kind of thing you get asked all the time as a monk, right? Why? You know, people want an answer to these things. And you can see why people want an answer. People want an answer to make sense of the world, right? That there's some kind of justice there, that the world isn't kind of a meaningless kind of heaping on of dukkha onto you. And once they have an explanation, people tend to feel better because things are somehow, if they're rational, you feel better about things in a certain way. But the reality is that the suttas don't say that. It's not all about karma. In fact, the suttas quite specifically says that there are a number of causes, a number of conditions for why we experience the world we do it in terms of suffering and pain specifically. And these causes have to do with all kinds of things, right? One of them, which is mentioned there, is like assault. Now, assault is the kind of thing that people would normally say, this must definitely be due to karma, because it's kind of a very serious and very difficult thing to deal with, you know, assault. But even those big things in life are often to do with, is just not actually attributable, according to the Buddha, directly to karma, but it is actually a separate cause, according to the Buddha. And that, of course, opens up the whole landscape, right? It opens up things radically, and it makes actually quite a massive change in how we view the world. Very often people ask, how is it, when there was that tsunami 12 years ago, whatever it was now, in Indonesia, in the Aceh province in the north of Indonesia, people were saying, how is it possible that 150,000 people died? They were all in the same place, whole villages wiped out, right? How can that be? How does that work with the teaching of karma? And of course, it doesn't really work. The point is that some of those people may have had bad karma, and they may have lost their life as a consequence, but many people were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that is what human existence often is about. We are in the wrong place at the wrong time, and then these things happen as a consequence. So once you move away from this idea that all experience is attributable to karma, then it opens up a way of understanding the world that is much more rational and much more easy to kind of integrate into our worldview, and it makes much more sense. Okay, next one. Next one that I took out specifically was this idea that having been reborn as a woman is a result of bad karma, which is often the kind of thing that you will, this is the kind of thing you will hear, and that you should strive to be reborn as a man in a future life, etc., etc. And again, of course, this is not something you find in the early Buddhist texts at all. Karma is about big things, right? Whether you get reborn in a high realm or a low realm, perhaps certain things within the human realm are attributable to karma. If you say die very young, or you are experience enormous amounts of suffering, it might be attributable to karma. But the idea that somehow being reborn as one gender rather than other one is attributable to karma is, there's nothing like that in the suttas at all, right, to make that even plausible as an argument. And I think this is an area where we have to be very careful, because once you say that certain things, certain characteristics, certain perhaps discriminations in society, being reborn as a, being reborn as slightly perhaps mentally retarded, perhaps all these kind of things, once we attribute these things to karma, it becomes like an excuse not to do anything about these issues. And that can be the case for gender discrimination. It can be the case for any kind of discrimination. It can be used for not doing something for anyone who is disadvantaged in our society. And so once we get onto that track, the idea of saying that disadvantage is a result of karma, and therefore excusing it, which often is the result of that, you're moving down a very dangerous track. And you're moving, instead of building up compassion, which is so important in Buddhism, you're excusing things, which actually we should do something as a group to help improve in our society instead. So it's a broader issue here. It's not just about being reborn as a woman being bad karma. It's a much broader issue of how we treat anyone who is disadvantaged in our society. And in the end, we're all disadvantaged in some way, right? Everybody's disadvantaged in some way. So basically, it comes back to compassion being the right attitude, and then dealing with the problems as they are, rather than trying to excuse them away into oblivion.
So you could argue that if somebody's sort of destined to experience that suffering, then by helping them to experience that suffering, you're helping them to burn off their past karma quickly.
That's exactly it.
So the compassionate thing to do is to keep people in the suffering that they're in so that they can get rid of their karma quickly. Yeah,
so that's kind of exactly it. And this is what kind of it's actually interesting in the euthanasia debate. You know, I often said that euthanasia, whether it's immoral or not, whether it's bad karma or not, depends on your intention, because everything is intention-based in Buddhism. But often the argument you get back is that, well, by euthanasia, you're not allowing the people to experience the karma. It's exactly the same argument, right? You're not allowing them. But maybe they need to experience this karma. And I say back, well, if you break your leg, are you going to go to hospital? Or are you just going to sit there, you know, allow the leg to be broken? Similar kind of thing. So it basically changes the mindset quite dramatically once you look at these things in this way.
We're kind of laughing about this, but it's not just theoretical. I mean, I was actually told this when I was in Thailand, when my knees were bad and things like that. Basically, don't have an operation because this is your karma and you need to go through it. Yeah, I had an operation. Just saying, all right?
And these were, like, who told you these things? What kind of?
I should probably avoid saying who told me that thing. But yeah.
Were they Western monks or traditional monks?
Thai monks.
Thai monks.
Yeah.
Thai monks. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Then we have another one which I thought, and this actually comes very much back to the same thing again. I know, this is a different one. Yeah. This idea that criticizing monastics is bad karma. This is, again, a view that is very, very prevalent. And you often hear people say, oh, we shouldn't say anything because it's bad speech to say bad things. But I was just a few days ago, I was reading out the sutta in the monastery, discussing a sutta called the Abhaya Raja Kumara Sutta, which is the sutta to Abhaya, who was a prince Abhaya. He was a son of King Bimbisara, according to the commentary here. And in this sutta, the Buddha talks about Devadatta, and he says that Devadatta has done all these bad things. And for that reason, he's destined to a bad rebirth. And then the Jains come and they say, well, you know, the Buddha, you're saying all these bad things. Devadatta didn't want to hear that. How can you, as the Buddha, say things that are unpleasant to other people? And the Buddha says, it's not about saying what is unpleasant or pleasant. It's about saying things that lead to growth, right? Lead to progress. So sometimes people need to hear things which are not pleasant in order to be able to grow. And the simile that's being used there is a nice little simile where this Prince Abhaya has a small child on his lap. And the Buddha says to him, well, if your little child there, if that child put something into its mouth, what would you do? And the Prince Abhaya said, well, even if I had to draw blood, I would quickly pull that thing out of the little baby's mouth, because otherwise it would choke and it would probably die right there. And exactly the same thing. Sometimes a little bit of hurt is necessary for, you know, for actually making progress in the long run. And this is all about sometimes we need to be challenged, right? I'm not sure if I'm going to maybe talk more about that further down, but sometimes we need to be challenged in Buddhism. Buddhism is a teaching which is very profound, and when you have a teaching like non-self, which goes so much against the grain of almost everyone, then you can expect that this kind of teaching is going to challenge you deeply in many, many different ways. And being challenged is not a bad thing. If it's done rightly and we receive the challenge in the right way, it is always a potential for growth. So it's actually a good thing, I reckon. So criticizing monastics is all about how we do it, right? Not just monastic, but anybody really, whether it's lay people, anyone. The way, if we criticize somebody, it is to show that there is a real problem going on. So say that there is a monk who is doing bad things, right? And then you say, well, and then you say so, that this monk isn't doing things in the right way, they're doing things in the wrong way, to help other people from kind of being trapped by something which isn't right. Then, of course, that is the right way of going about things. Do it with kindness, do it with a sense of responsibility, with a sense of wisdom, and then you can't really go wrong here in that sense. In fact, I would say if we don't warn against, you know, people being abused, monastics doing the wrong thing, if we don't warn about that, that is actually probably, in my view, that is what actually is worse karma than saying something. We should warn about things which are dangerous and things that are likely to hurt other people. If we don't, that is where we're going wrong here.
Yes, that's a really good point, actually. And, you know, if you compare it to, say, just somebody driving a car down a road, you know, and You know, you know that the bridge has fallen in around the corner. You have a moral obligation to tell people, don't drive down, it's unsafe. And it's the same thing. If you see people practicing in a way, maybe following a teacher who you know is corrupt or something like that, then it's important to warn people. Not in a way of attacking or just because you're negative, but just people, we need to share. We need to help each other.
Yeah. It's astonishing how this kind of views, when you think about it rationally, it kind of makes so much sense that this should be the case. Mm. But how these views kind of tend to get very entrenched is kind of worrying sometimes. So.
And I think we made this point during the course, but it's not as if this isn't something which is unprecedented or even vaguely uncommon. In fact, it's the vinaya, almost every second rule is the lay people complaining about the monks. And never once in all of those times does the Buddha criticize the lay people, right? He never says, you lay people shouldn't criticize the monks. He investigates the problem. If it's true, then he'll do something about it. If it's not, then he'll dismiss it. But he never criticizes the lay people for the act of criticism.
Yes. Okay. So that is about criticizing monastics. And one last point I wanted to mention is the idea of burning off karma, which is a very common, again, idea in Buddhist circles. You sit down, for example, it's very common in meditation circles, that if you feel a lot of pain in meditation, what you are doing is you're burning off the bad karma of the past, and therefore it's good to sit down and burn it off and not to move, etc. But again, this idea that you're supposed to burn off karma is actually a Jain idea. The Jains were the ones who propounded this doctrine. You end up burning off all bad karma and not making any new one. And those two things together means you make an end of the cycle of rebirth. It's not a Buddhist idea at all. It's kind of infiltrated into Buddhism via whatever channels. And here again, you get the same problem again I was talking about before about euthanasia. You can see that it's not about burning off bad karma, because any kind of medical treatment you take, right, that is just the good karma you have to be, this is one way of looking at it, it's the good karma you have to be able to counteract that bad karma. So this becomes a very lopsided view of things again. So there were many, many more of these myths that we talked about last time, but I think that's probably enough to summarize a little bit. So what I thought to do at this stage, and maybe to try to generalize a little bit about what kind of lessons to be learned from this, what, you know, why bring this up, what can we actually do about this, I think one of the things that I think for me anyway, which kind of comes out, is this idea that myths are inevitable. There's always going to be myths coming around. There's always going to be things which aren't really true, so you always have to be kind of on the lookout. And this is, I think, is one of the things that started from the very beginning of Buddhism. From the very beginning, the Buddha says in a particular sutta that gradually the false teachings will arise in the world, right? And as the false teachings arise, the more powerful they become, the weaker become the real teachings of the Buddha. So it's something that you can expect. It's something that you always have to be on the guard out for. Is the danger of legends and mythology taking over and they becoming a substitute for the real teachings of Buddhism. I think if the Buddha were around today and he saw the state of Buddhism in the world, the various types of Buddhism that exist today, he would be quite surprised. I don't know, surprised, or perhaps he would be shocked, or perhaps he would be to see things that have got nothing to do with early Buddhism and being called Buddhism, nothing to do with Dhamma. But still being called Buddhism in a certain way. It's actually very hard to keep these teachings intact and to actually remember what the core and real teachings of the Buddha are. And of course, the only way to do that is to go back, to be radical, to, you know, this is one of the great things I think Pandasujato has done, this idea of, you know, discovering what are the real teachings of the Buddha. Be radical about it. Not be afraid of questioning it. And then drawing that out in a rational and sound way, and then being able to look at what we are doing in the world today, whether it actually is in accordance with that or not. But I also think that one of the important things as well is this idea, it's not just that there are lots of myths in Buddhism, but I think one of the problems is that each one of us is likely to believe in a number of myths, right? Often we don't know that. We're not aware of the own myths that we carry around as part of our own mental baggage, so to speak, from the past. So, and we all have these things inside of us, right? And I'm sure that I have no doubt that for myself, there's many things that I'm blind to. And I know that simply from, from reading the Buddha's teachings, from very profound teachings like the ideas of non-self. As long as those things haven't penetrated 100%, you know that there are areas that you're going to be slightly blind to. You're going to believe in certain mythology and legends to some extent. And because of that, I think one of the lessons to me to be drawn from this is always to have an open mind, always to be willing to listen, always be willing to see another point of view of things, always being willing to have your assumptions and your views challenged, right? When somebody says, I don't believe this is true, then instead of just rejecting it outright, at the very least, to have an open mind. Of course, you shouldn't accept it outright either, because you need to investigate these things, but to have an open mind and to be open to challenges, open to alternative ways of looking at things, because we all have this problem inside of us. It's not just us sitting here and sorting out, everybody else's views. It's also about our own personal problems inside. Okay, Bunty, do you want to add anything to that?
There was a very nice article in the ABC website a couple of weeks ago about this Burmese monk who was doing this radical innovation, teaching. He was like setting up a school in the monastery, and they were teaching the kids and things like that. And he had this radical innovation of teaching the kids critical thinking. Okay, and this is like completely unheard of, right? And actually teaching the kids to ask questions and to not blindly accept everything that he said, and giving them the tools to find out answers for themselves. And the kids were like, it was amazing to see the responses from the kids and how much they loved it, by comparison. They're like, all we've ever learnt before is just rote learning. This is what it is, and you just have to get it in there. And you could see that their minds are just kind of leaping forward, to want to learn and want to inquire. Obviously so ironic to see that this, critical thinking and inquiry, which is so fundamental in the early Buddhist teachings, in which the Buddha taught so many times in so many different ways, and almost every sutta is like the monks asking questions from the Buddha and all of these kinds of things. And it's not as if it's a small part of it. It's there all the time. And yet has dropped so far out of the Buddhist tradition that now when that happens, people are like, oh yeah, this is a Western innovation that you have to bring into the Buddhist teachings, So something that I really encourage you, and this is why we'll look later at Barbara's research. And, that was so heartening to see that somebody would actually take the time and the trouble to like seriously look at these things rather than just accepting it. Okay, maybe questions. Any questions about those myths or any other ones that you had any doubts about, or are your myths thoroughly busted? Miriam. So if you wait just 1 second, we'll just for the benefit of the recording, if there is such a thing, maybe that's another myth. I think that there's another myth that these courses are going to be recorded every week.
Yeah, that's
anyway, sorry, go on.
Yeah, everything caused by karma. What about, I can understand how it would be the case that not... Sorry, I missed the very first class as well, so this might be coming from ignorance. But I can see how it would be the case that not every single event that happens to you is correlated with a previous action that you did to get that karma. But might it not still be the case that your being born into samsara is still, very broadly speaking, karmic? So in that general sense, everything is caused by karma.
Sure. Everything in that sense, karma is a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition. Yeah. So the fact that we've been reborn. Now, the fact that we've been reborn in the human realm and in a particular space within that human realm means that there are certain kinds of karma, certain kinds of experience, which we're likely to have or that we're likely to not have. Right. And so in that will influence what sort of karma might ripen and so on and so forth. Yeah, so karma is an influencing factor, but it's not determining everything. Yeah.
I like the idea that, you know, once you get reborn in a particular realm, that particular realm sets like limits for what kind of experience you can have. So the human realm sets certain limits and you will experience things within those limits. But what actually happens within those limits is pretty up to a large number of causes and conditions that are relevant. Yeah.
You certainly may. One microphone.
I just wonder, you know, I hear a lot of people saying, oh, it's their bad karma because they've been murdered or whatever. But I'm wondering about the people who actually carry out these crimes. And just in the news recently, there's been these hideous attacks from unspeakable people. So what sort of karma are we looking at when people can chop the head off somebody else or do horrible things to them? No, I'm very confused about
that. That's bad karma.
Yes, that would be very bad karma. But why do they do it?
Why do they do it?
That makes them become murderers or makes them become liars.
Yeah.
You know, what's in their background that makes it okay? Or do we have some sort of choice, some sort of mindfulness?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the point is that we're influenced by the past, but you know, that doesn't determine it and doesn't fix it. So, I mean, people do bad things because of all kinds of reasons, yeah? And in some cases there are conditions that might help you to understand why they do that. I read a very interesting long article many years ago. It was an account of a court case in the US, and what happened was that this young guy, 20 or something like that, had robbed a 7-Eleven or something, gone in there with a gun, robbed it, and ended up shooting the store owner. And it was all on cameras and that, and he confessed. There was no question that he did it. There's no question it was murder. It was unprovoked, anything. He was completely guilty. But the story of the court case was very interesting because the lawyers didn't try to prove he was innocent or anything like that, but all they did was talked about his background. And, they talked about the home that he came from and his parents, and he was beaten as a kid and all of these kinds of things and all the things you might expect. And he'd been through such a horrible life. And the point that they were making was not that that excuses it. It's not that it makes it all right, but it makes it a little bit more comprehensible. It makes that person's behavior a little less alien, right? And during the trial, all of the jurors went from being 100% in favor of the death penalty, but by the end of the trial, they'd commuted it to life imprisonment. And so that was, you know, that was like a big shift, you know, because they felt a sense of connection with that person. And again, it's not a matter of excusing it, right? No matter, you know, there are plenty of people who are born into terrible situations and subject to terrible abuse who come out of it and just do amazing things. When I was in India with my friend Sister Yeshe, when was it now? Early last year, she introduced me to some of her students. Jake, I can't see Jake's not around at the moment. Jake would remember he videoed it. I might even show the video if I get around to it later. But it was just an amazing thing because there were these young kids, right? They were born in the Dalit community in Maharashtra. You know, it's one of the most poor slum outcast areas in the whole world, basically. And they're born into this place and, you know, she was just this young girl telling a story. She was like 18 or 19 or something, and she was born into this family. And you could see she wasn't telling it out of like bitterness or anger or anything. She was just telling a story. She just lived in a tin shack with just one room with her parents and her sisters. And her father used to drink every night, used to beat the wife up every day, and used to beat the children every day. And she was just talking about all this abuse, everything she'd suffered her whole life. And now things were probably even worse because now her father was so sick because he'd been drinking so much that he was just in bed all the time and they were having to look after him after he'd abused them his whole life. And you see, this young woman was so radiant and full of kindness. And she said, and all I want to do is do my studies and so I can learn to become a social worker so that I can help people who are in that situation. it was just amazing to see. Yeah, and so we're not trapped by these things. We can always make a choice.
Mm. There's a
conditionality. There's conditionality. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the fact that you behead somebody else. It's not due to karma. It's not the fact that you behead somebody else. It's maybe due to all kind of conditioning processes, including your habits from the past and all kind of things. So that is kind of one aspect of it. But of course, the moment you behead somebody, then you're creating really bad karma. So all that kind of past conditioning, all your past habits, they come together and then make you do something terrible, which then has a tremendous impact on what you feel in the future. Karma is not about our intention or volition or what we do. Karma is about how we experience the world in terms of pleasure and pain. That's what karma really is about. And of course, the person whose head was chopped off, obviously that is quite likely. I mean, it's a pretty gruesome thing. So that is quite possibly likely to be the result of something bad from the past. So you had to look at these things. You had to kind of tease out which aspect is karma, because we tend to kind of, karma becomes this catch-all phrase to mean everything, right? But actually, karma is very specific. It's intentional action resulting either pleasure or pain as a result. That's really what it is about.
Thank you. Could you please just summarize or recapitulate on the relationship between karma and making merit, the sort of all the big rituals and all that stuff around making merit and sharing merits and sharing blessings and all of that I remember we touched on, but
okay.
It's a little bit confusing.
Yeah, sharing merits and karma and making merit, all those things. Okay, I think, basically, I think making merit and making karma is pretty much the same thing. Making merit focuses obviously on the good karma, but basically, making good karma and making merit is largely the same thing. Yeah. If you look at the way that merit is normally defined in the suttas, it's divided threefold. There's the merit of generosity, the merit of sila, and the merit of bhavana, which is the development of the mind. So threefold merit, if I'm right. So that is really the thing. And of course, sharing merit, that was another of the myths that we actually busted at that time, we talked about. And it was one of the myths that we kind of had in the gray area, because obviously there is some truth to the idea of, not sharing. I think the problem there is actually the wording is a problem. It's how we talk about this. And we talk about it as sharing merit. It's actually the way it is labeling is the problematic thing here. But there is presumably some kind of connection between what we do and what other people can actually receive that in a certain way through our kindness. That may still be there, although it's not really sharing merit. It's more like the ability to influence other people in experiencing a sense of happiness or whatever because of the actions that we do. I think the labeling is the biggest problem. The word transference is a problematic there. It's more like, as well as that, when you make an act of generosity for something else, you dedicate it. Uddissa is the Pali word for that. So you dedicate it to them. And then once you dedicate to them, they might be able to receive that in a certain way, in a sense of feeling happy about it or tuning into that in a certain way. But it's not actually, take my merit and you get my merit. That's impossible.
If it was possible to do that, then you'd have professionals who would make a living out of it, right?
Yeah.
Right? I'll go off and give some money to charity and do some community work, and you can go off drinking and gambling or whatever, and then I can give you my merit later on. It's kind of what happens, yeah. Do you want to watch the movie? Yeah? Okay, I'll see if I can get this working. Not 100% sure. Let's see if we can go. What do we have? Computer. Installing. Yes. So just to give you the background to this, as I mentioned before, my friend Sister Yeshe, who I've known for more than 10 years now in Sydney, she runs a centre in Maharashtra called the Bodhicitta Centre, Bodhicitta Foundation, where she helps to look after the Dalit people who are from the outcast in India and have converted to Buddhism. And she helps to sort of provide support for the community there. Goodness, what are we doing?
Okay, please just go. Do we have going?
Ah, here we go. So there should be subtitles, I think. Oh no, she's translating. I didn't think it was so fairly subtitled. Can you hear that? No. We might have to wait. I might wait till. That's going to be really bad. Oh, well, I'll try it. After the break. So sorry, I thought I had subtitles. So obviously not. Okay. Next one. Yeah. Hiya.
Yes. Just coming back to what Pauline said earlier about the example of the head being chopped off by a person. Now, if the karma of a person is to be killed, it always needs somebody to kill. So that's something which I still can't get my head around, that the personal karma also needs to be fulfilled, and in this case, somebody needs to kill for the person, that person's karma to be fulfilled, to be killed. So yeah. I still don't know how that goes together and how we can get it.
I don't think the karma is ever to be killed. I think the karma is to die, perhaps, but not to be killed. You can die in different ways, right? So it doesn't actually take, it can take a tsunami, an act of God, so it might be... Or whatever, but it's not necessarily that another person will have to kill you. It's just that, you know, basically, I think one of the places where it talks about these kind of things, which is in the Chula Kama Vibhanga Sutta, Majjhima 135, which is a short discourse on the analysis of karma, it says that if you do the wrong things, then your life will be short. That's all it says. It doesn't say that you have to be killed. So there's no need for kind of a human agency there to, you know, to shorten your life, anything like that. So I don't think that, I think that is kind of perhaps one of those myths that needs to be busted, that somebody has to kill you, you know. Maybe another one for the next workshop or something. Yeah.
Maybe it's not kind of like being killed. Yes, we will die in any way, but if the karma might be kind of to experience violence or violent death or kind of being, how to say, yes, experience violence from another person, and that person actually in this moment is,
You can't have karma to experience violence from another person. The other person's choice is their own choice. This is a myth. Okay, this is not how things happen. All of those stories that you hear about these, all of these come from commentaries and so on. There's nothing even vaguely like that in the suttas. Okay, so the universe does not conspire in order to make you experience the karma that you want. Okay. Karma isn't a mysterious force that magically makes things happen, right? It's just a law of cause and effect. Yeah? So just understand it in a simple way. You know, it's like if you smoke cigarettes, then the likelihood is that you're going to have some health problems or whatever. You know, but it's not like there's some sort of mysterious force that's making you do that. Yeah.
I think also in the end that there's our society is such and humanity is such, there's always going to be plenty enough people out there who will do this kind of thing, right? Not as if there's a shortage of people who will do things that are bad or evil or this kind of things. The human spectrum is always so broad. So I think that it's not as if we are compelling somebody to do anything at all. There are enough people who will do this quite freely and voluntarily on their own account, unfortunately, in the world.
So maybe take one more question, then should we have a short meditation and then do the second session? Okay, yes.
I heard another possible myth along those lines that it's not possible for it's only possible for a male to become a Buddha. Is that also from the commentaries, or is it I have a sutta background?
Sure, I can do that. I can answer that. So it's not actually from the commentary. It's actually found a couple of places in the suttas, but it's what you call a very marginal thing. It's found twice or something in the Pali Canon, and both of those places are fairly minor and obscure, and it kind of occurs as part of a long list of different factors. And this particular question was actually studied in quite a lot of detail by Venerable Analayo, who was probably the foremost scholar in the world in comparative studies, compares it with the Chinese and with other languages, the Pali Canon. And he concluded that that particular passage of only you have to be male to become a Buddha was probably not actually part of the original teachings of the Buddha. That's what he concluded. You can read that online. It's available online. It's available in a journal called the Journal of Buddhist Ethics. So if you Google that, Journal of Buddhist Ethics, and then Analayo, and you get the right keyword, you can read the article online.
This is the Bahudhataka
Sutta, and also in the Anguttara Ones, I think. Yeah. It's there as well. Yeah.
Okay, so let's just do a couple of minutes meditation before moving on to discuss the second workshop. Okay, so we'll move on to the next session where we'll look at something of the historical background to the notion of karma. And okay, so I might just make a couple of notes as we go. Okay. First thing is, don't be afraid of history. And don't be afraid of the facts. And so sometimes, and I think it's not at all uncommon in religious circles that we find this sort of pervasive distortion of facts and telling of stories which is purely just driven by an ideology, it's driven by a need to construct a particular kind of reality. Whereas in Buddhism, ultimately, we're concerned about what is true. And what is true, when what is true conflicts with what our own ideas are, that's good. Right? That's when we can start to learn. If the truth and our ideas are the same, that's very boring. Okay? You don't get a chance to learn. Yeah, you don't get a chance to grow. And so, you know, we should try to learn at least something, or at least be open. I mean, we're not all going to put the effort in to become a professional historian or anything like that, but we should try to learn and try to understand something about the history of Buddhism and not be afraid when things come up. So this is, I think, the first one. And just to look briefly at the historical basis, the word karma is to do something, and one of the root meanings or most common meanings of the word karma is to work. Okay, and this is a meaning which we still resonates in the Pali canon. Right? So the important thing about this is to remember that karma is not a mystical term. Right? One of the problems with adopting words, right? When you adopt the word karma into the English language, it sounds like you're talking about some kind of special woo-woo juice, right? Whereas in Pali, it's this kind of bog ordinary everyday word, yeah? And it's interesting how these things happen. I remember a remark once by the psychologist Ken Wilber, who's talking about Freud, and he said that Freud, in all his writings, never used the word ego, nor did he ever use the word id, right? And so these things which we take as being basic to the idea of what Freud talked about, he never mentioned a single time in his writings. Why? Because when he was talking, he used the ordinary, everyday German words for these things, right? He'd use the word the I, or the self, right? Or the it, not the id. But when they translated him into English, they felt that sounded too kind of normal and not formal and sophisticated enough, so they used Latin words to translate his everyday language, right? And it immediately makes it like it's... I could never understand when I was first reading about what Freud was talking about. What did he mean by the ego? I'd never figure out what it was. But he's just talking about the sense of self, that's all. And so the same thing sometimes in Buddhism, when we translate the word karma into English, this is one thing I'm thinking about when doing translations of Buddhist texts. Even though the word karma is an English word these days, are we best off to actually leave it as karma if we're translating, or are we best off to translate it? Because the translation can sometimes be less misleading than using the Indian word, yeah, because it's got so many connotations. So it just means to do work, to do an act, okay? Now, but specifically, it means to do some kind of act that has a result, okay? And one of the most important kinds of act is ploughing the fields, sowing the rice, growing the crops, yeah? You do the work now, you get the results later, right? It's an agrarian culture, very, very important. Kamang ketang. Okay. Ketang. Okay. Oops. Oops. Okay. Kamanketang, yeah. So, karma is the field. Right? And so this is the imagery that the Buddha was drawing from. Right? It's ordinary, everyday language and giving it some kind of new meaning. But that basic idea that we do something now, we do an intentional act now, and it has some result later on. Okay? This is very important. Other meaning of karma.
Why is karma the field?
Karma is the field. Why is karma the field? Well, you tell us. You're asking the question. Go on.
Exactly, that's the
point
I'm asking.
Why is karma the field? Well, I think karma... Okay, go on. No. Well, I think karma is the field because I think that's your workplace, basically, right? So what's your work? Your work is tilling. Your work is the field, yeah. So I think it's like an idiom to talk about that's what you do, yeah.
But I think in a Buddhist context, karma is the field means that karma is kind of it has to do with rebirth, right?
You have
the field. So the field is kind of where you place your consciousness in a certain field. It's like a human realm is a field in a sense.
Okay, yeah.
And then you experience the result as a consequence.
Yeah. You know, for example, in the well-known story when the Bodhisattva was meditating under the rose apple tree when he was a young boy, and it says his father was off working, right? And so his father was off doing karma, right? That's what it is. When dad's gone off to work, he's gone off to do karma. Come on to, yeah. Okay. Yes. It's something like that, yes. So again, maybe just wait for the. We'll anticipate the miraculous, and we hope this is going to be recorded. Yeah.
So that the field is the consciousness of the person that is the karma.
Something.
Consciousness of the person.
It's very closely related. Yeah. The full phrase is kaman ketang vinyanang bijang tanha sneho, right? Karma is the field. Consciousness is the seed, and craving is the snot.
The snot.
What? Snareha is etymologically related to the English snot. Snot and also snow. And snow and snot, yeah. But perhaps it didn't quite mean that in that context, yeah. Usually translated as moisture, yeah. So craving is the moisture, yeah. So then, and that specifically is talking about how rebirth takes place in particular realms, right? So it's those factors working together, yeah. So the karma is a keta, yeah. Okay. Karma is Chetana. Yeah.
Not only you, every thought, the intent will cause karma, isn't it?
But I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
I will say, if I am conspiring to do something bad, the intent to kill.
Yeah.
Self is karma, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so, but here we're talking not about the Buddhist idea of karma, we're talking about what are the roots of the word that are already meant in the Buddhist culture, the roots that the Buddha was drawing on in his explanation of karma. So the second very important meaning that karma had in that context was ritual. Okay, so and it's impossible to overestimate the significance of ritual within Indian religious practice. Okay, the whole Vedic Brahmanical practice was based on very elaborate, very sophisticated performance of different rituals, with they had different officiants and different kinds of priests doing recitation and, you know, all these different things, and arrange, everything had to be arranged, very kind of detailed instructions on how the shrines were constructed and what different offerings had to be made and how to propitiate different deities and how to get different results and so on. It was a very, very sophisticated art, and it really dominated the religious praxis in the period before the Buddha, as indeed it still does. And so the word karma means the rituals, but when you do a ritual, you think about what it is that you're doing. So what you're doing as a ritual is you're doing some kind of deliberate, focused, intentional action, which is intended to produce some kind of result. All right? And this is one area where Indian religions are quite distinctly different from Western religions, okay? In Western religions, right, we have this notion of prayer, okay? And so prayer basically has two aspects. Number one is you butter up the god, and number two, you ask for something, okay? All right? Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, right? All of that stuff, then give us this day our daily bread. Yeah, forgive us our trespasses. Yeah? And so this is the two things. So you're asking for something from the god, right? Whereas in the Indian sphere, and this was the case even before the Buddha, you're not asking the gods for anything. I mean, you might formally ask them for something, right? But they don't have a choice in the matter, right? In the Western idea, the gods are beyond the world, and God creates the world and all the laws that govern the world, right? Whereas in the Indian context, the gods are within the world. They are participants in that same system, the same network of cause and effect that you and I are in, okay? And so within that Indian system, the Brahmins argued that they had a special dispensation from the god that they could kind of hook into the way that the universe worked, right, through reciting the Vedas and through doing the rituals and things, so that when they did the ritual properly, gods didn't have any choice, right? They compelled the gods to act on their behalf, okay? And of course they could prove this is the case, right? I mean, it's not as if this is just something they made up, because every morning they recite the Gayatri mantra to invoke the rising of the sun. And look, the sun rises. Right? And this is proven every day, cause and effect. Right? I mean, are you blind? Can you not see? This is cause and effect right before your eyes. And so this is how they would do the same thing for the changes of the seasons, for the sowing of the harvest, for marriages, for the stages of life, for the when people went into different positions in society, like kings or whatever. And all of the, when you wanted to harm your enemies, or when you wanted to get wealth, or anything like that, there are the specific rituals for these things. You do that ritual act, and you get the result from that act. And that act is the karma. And so that, now, before the Buddha, there were these, the question had arisen was, what is the involvement of the mind in that? Okay? Now, originally, the ritual is purely an external thing. Right? We have to remember this. It's purely the mechanical performance of certain acts which creates the result. Right? Your mind state during that performance is completely meaningless. It's irrelevant. They've never even given any thought to it. Right? But then at a certain point, people start to ask, how does this actually work and what's going on? And this was the characteristic in the Upanishadic period, which emerged about perhaps 200 years before the Buddha. And the most characteristic phrase in the Veda, most characteristic phrase in the Upanishadic period is Yayavam Veda. It talks about all of the rituals, the acts, the chanting, everything they're doing, and it talks about how you understand this, right? And he says, oh, you have to see that when you are offering, that this particular part of the ceremony has this correlation. They use the word sandhi, right? There's this invisible network that connects every little detail that you do in your ritual with something, a reality that happens in the universe, okay? Briharanyaka Upanishad begins with the horse sacrifice, and it talks about how every aspect of the horse in the horse sacrifice relates to the world. For example, when the horse urinates, that's when the thunder cloud opens and it rains from the sky, okay? So they don't neglect any details, right? And so all of these little things, there's these connections. And the performance of the ritual, the successful performance of the ritual, depends on Ya Evang Veda, one who knows this. Yeah? And so they're beginning to distinguish, right? Because obviously the problem is that while some rituals are successful every time, like, say, making the sun rise, that one works very, very reliably, but other ones don't work reliably. Sometimes the priest will come and do the ritual for the falling of the rains, okay? And then that year there's no rain falls, right? What's going on? He did the ritual, okay? We saw, you know, we paid good money for it, right? We did the sacrifices, we did everything right, and yet the rains didn't come. What's the problem, okay? Well, everything was right on the outside. There must have been something wrong on the inside, right? Something was wrong internally. That priest wasn't pure, maybe. They didn't understand what they were doing. They didn't do it the right way inside. So you can see how this system is gradually evolving. They're asking these questions. So that by the time of the Upanishads, they're saying, Ya Evang Veda, one who understands this, one who knows this. And they're also starting to point to an alternative beyond karma, right? So they're beginning to look that you can, if you do the rituals and so on right, you can go to a good place, you can get reborn on the moon, or reborn in the world of the fathers, or something like that, and live happily with them. But they're also beginning to recognize an idea of liberation, of vimoka, of something which was beyond karma, beyond rebirth. Yeah? And so these are some of the ideas which the Buddha was drawing from, or which had an affinity with the Buddha's ideas. And it even went so far in a few passages before the Buddha's time that it asked the question, like, what if they can't do the ritual properly? What if they don't have the materials they need? What if you don't have somebody to do the recitation and all of those things? And it says, even if you do it by faith, then it can still be effective. Okay? So just in a purely internal thing can sometimes be effective. So this is one of the strands which the Buddha was drawing on in understanding and presenting the teaching on karma and rebirth. So the radical part of the Buddha's teachings was how he divested the whole teaching of karma and rebirth from any kind of ritual trappings and presented it purely as an ethical teaching. Okay? And this is a very, very disturbing and quite destabilizing teaching. Okay? Because, you know, when you think about it, you have an elite, right? The Brahmins who are an elite who kind of trying to position themselves as a sort of unique intermediary between humanity and God, or between humanity and the divine. And the Buddha points out, well, sometimes Brahmins live good lives and sometimes they don't. Yeah, and sometimes they do good things and sometimes they don't. And the same thing with a Kshatriya, same thing with the Vesa, the Sudra. Even the outcasts sometimes can live a good life or sometimes a bad life. Isn't that the important thing? And there's a number of dialogues in the suttas that talk about this. A nice one is in the, one of the ones in the Digha Nikaya, and they begin with a list of all the things that make a true Brahmin, and they say you have to have pure parentage back to seven generations, and you have to have knowledge of the Vedas, and you have to, I can't remember, I think there was one other one, and then it was you have to have good sila, so good conduct, and you have to have wisdom. And the Buddha says, well, are there any of these that are not strictly speaking necessary? And they say, well, okay, we can drop the requirement for pure rebirth, pure birth, seven generations. And all the other Brahmins who were there got really upset with him. But he said, no, okay, we can get without. And he said, are there any others you can leave out? And he said, well, we can probably leave out the thing about knowing the Vedas. And then I think there was one more. Can you remember which one it was? Anyway, there was one more thing like that. And then eventually he got down to sila, to precepts and wisdom. And he said, can you leave either of those things out? And he said, no, you can't leave any of those things out. Right? So this is that process that the Buddha took to just leave aside all of those things which were not necessary. And, you know, always remember that, you know, in Buddhism we do lots and lots of different rituals and things like that. Some of the rituals we do in Buddhism are just sort of observance of ordinary, polite and respectful forms, right? Like, say, bowing to somebody out of respect or making anjali and these kinds of things. And some of them are part of our just sort of knowledge and learning and joining with the community. So things like chanting and so on, where we're sort of learning the Dhamma and things like that. And so, you know, there are these elements which have a ritualistic aspect to them. And if they're done with the right spirit and the right understanding, ya evang veda, then there is no problem. But too often in Buddhism, we sort of slide back to this kind of magical thinking, where if we can just do the ritual itself, then that's the powerful thing. I was in Bodhnyana a couple of months ago, and this Thai lady came and she wanted me to do holy water sprinkling on her car. And I said to her, oh, you know, this is a Thai, you know, customer said, you know, that they'll give you protection for your car, right? And she's like, yeah, that gives you protection. I said, oh, so I said, in Thailand, all the monks do that and all the cars have water sprinkled on them. And she said, yes, they do it all the time. But in Australia, nobody does it. And she said, that's right. In Australia, nobody has their car sprinkled. I said, where do they have more traffic accidents, in Thailand or in Australia? She kind of stopped. In Thailand, actually, yeah. Don't you think it's more important to be mindful when you're driving your car rather than having water sprinkled on it? And she said, yeah, you're probably right.
It works for carefully, right?
That's the point, yeah. So again, so, you know, there's, the Buddha, you know, we don't be extreme with these things. Right? The Buddha never said, you know, you can't do any rituals or anything like that. But he was much more about, you know, so he would certainly say you shouldn't do any rituals that are going to be harmful, right? Particularly those involving animal sacrifice or human sacrifice, right? But if the ritual itself is not harmful, and, you know, it's a simple thing which is helping you to, you know, develop your mindfulness or whatever, it's not that you can't do those things, but just understand that the ritual itself is not going to, you know, bring you liberation or anything like that. So the karma really is the ethical side of things. And so this is very destabilizing for the Brahmanical caste in India. It was essentially saying they had no special access to the sacred, that anybody who did what is good could achieve liberation or get a heavenly rebirth or achieve liberation. And so this is one of the reasons why the Brahmins, or some of the Brahmins, didn't like what the Buddha said. Of course, within the Brahmanical caste, as with any group of people, there's a lot of diversity, and many of the Brahmins became followers of the Buddha or at least had a lot of sympathy with what he was saying. In fact, similar conversations were taking place within the Brahmanical sphere itself. It wasn't just a Buddhist thing. But on the whole, the tendency was for the Buddhist teachings to question the authority of the Brahmins, and this is something which is still very much the case today in India, where the Buddhist teachings are a challenge and a threat to some of the aspects of the Hindu system, especially with the caste system. Just very briefly, just to round off on the historical background, and this is something that Venerable Brahmali alluded to beforehand. In ancient India, there was a tremendous diversity of views. In fact, in those days, probably in some ways, there's more diverse religious sphere than it is today in a country like Australia. I mean, people were doing all kinds of things, right? You know, you can wander around naked and torture yourself or go around acting like a dog or something like that. And everyone was like, oh, yeah, we'll respect them. They're holy men, right? You try doing that in Australia, you're not going to get very far. So it's very diverse, and people had all different kinds of ideas. And so that, of course, some of these ideas were around. Oh, sorry, I should have mentioned before with point number five, is that that idea of karma, the ethical dimension of karma, is something which, as far as I know, is raised in one passage, which is a pre-Buddhist Upanishadic passage, and that passage is very significant because when it is mentioned, the teacher takes the questioner by the arm and leads them to one side, and so they can discuss in private. Okay, so this is about maybe 100 years before the Buddha, not very long, in the same region the Buddha was teaching. And that the idea that karma was an ethical thing, right, rather than a ritual thing, was considered so explosive, right, so controversial, that it couldn't be discussed in public at all. Right? Had to be discussed in secret. Yeah. So, but by the time of the Buddha, that wasn't the case anymore. The idea that karma was ethical was not a... it's not unique to Buddhism, similar ideas in Jainism as well, and in some of the strands of Hindu philosophy as well. So there was tremendous diversity, and the Buddha drew on certain ideas from different places, but he divested them and altered them, divested them of their ritual and superstitious aspects, and he sort of firmly placed them within that Buddhist psychological context, where, of course, the famous statement that was alluded to earlier, "Jednaham bhikkhave kammang vadami," it is intention that I say is karma. And so in this way, he's making karma much more of an internal act, and what are we going to choose to do? And so as with any actor in history, the Buddha is not determined by historical forces. And, you know, one of the problems with the idea that was the first myth that was busted by Ajahn Brahmali earlier is the idea that if this idea was in Indian culture, therefore the Buddha must have just been determined by that culture or something like that. I mean, it's completely absurd. You know, we all have the ability to think critically about the ideas around us and to investigate them and inquire, accept some things, reject other things. And if we can do that, I'm sure the Buddha was perfectly capable of doing it as well. What has happened is that the Buddha launched his revolution in the understanding of karma, okay? But that has only ever been partially successful, right? As with all of the Buddha's revolution. I mean, the Buddha was so far ahead of his time and so sophisticated that the Buddha's community and Buddha's culture has sort of struggled to keep up. And many of the more primitive ideas about karma seeped back into the Buddhist tradition, as we've heard very often in that myth-busting session. And this actually came up in the discussions in Sakyadita, where there was a presentation on the teachings of Ambedkar, the great Indian pundit who revitalized Buddhism in India. And one of the most controversial things that Ambedkar did was that he said that the teaching on karma and rebirth was not a real Buddhist teaching, and it was a later Hindu interpolation. And this was quite a... it was one of the means that he used to encourage the outcasts, the Dalit people in India, to embrace Buddhism because they were no longer going to be oppressed by the caste. I think it was a mistake, and I think I like to imagine that if Dr. Ambedkar had lived for a bit longer, that his life was tragically cut off too short. If he'd lived longer, he probably would have maybe changed those ideas, I suspect. But anyway, the point is that the Buddha didn't reject the ideas of karma and rebirth, but he adapted them and he presented them from his own perspective. Okay, so questions, comments, Venerable?
First question about it. Interestingly, as you say, there was great diversity in those days. it was obviously a culture of a lot of discussion and arguments about things. And then you say that, you know, there is this Gayatri mantra, which is supposed to make the sun rise. I mean, and then the proof is the sun rises every day, right? I mean, are we really to believe that people actually believe that in such a sophisticated society that it was, with all the discussion that people actually believe these things? Are we supposed to, you know, accept that on faith or?
Sure, they believed it.
Yeah,
they still believe it. Yeah.
I think the causality that's involved with maybe with the sun rising and saying a mantra is even because it's so close to us. Whereas the sun, you know, the world being created, you know, in 7 days, it's kind of a long time ago, and it's very much more distant in a sense. But this is kind of in your face, right?
If you look at the logic, I mean, the sun is a god, obviously, right? I mean, nothing could be more godlike than the sun, right? So if you're going to have a sun, the god's going to be one of them, or is going to be mixed up in there somehow. And also the other basic principle is that the gods are subject to human intervention, right? So the gods are part of that world which is governed by the ritual. These are two basic assumptions of the culture. So it's not that the rising of the sun is a purely physical, mechanical process. That whole cosmology wasn't really there. So it almost, in fact, inevitably follows on from that. I mean, obviously there would have been people questioning it and so on and so forth. But the basic idea, yeah, is that there is this cause and effect. It is a topic which is discussed and which is debated in anthropology, right? I don't want to get too much into it, but the first sort of major documenter of this in the West was James Frazer, and he much emphasized this kind of magical causality aspect of ritual and so on. And he was later criticized by other people who argued that it wasn't about making things happen, but about like recognizing and celebrating the connections between things, right? So that doing the chant with the rising of the sun wasn't about making the sun rise, it was about becoming part of that and participating in the sunrise. And so, yes, there's some element of that as well. It's not purely a causal thing, but there definitely is a causal aspect to it, and I think it's naive to suspect that there isn't. I mean, just recently, they banned on various online retailers, I can't remember which ones it was, eBay and a couple of others, the selling of magic spells, right? Right. So this is now in the terms of use. You can't actually buy and sell sort of magic online. Yeah, and these are specifically still things people are doing, magic, in order to get some particular result. You know, so, yeah.
Sorry. Day you have a rest.
The universe was made in 6 days. The universe was made in 6 days, and the seventh day he had a rest, which is the world's first workplace industrial relations legislation, right? It was put down, right? Guaranteeing a rest day for the workers. In fact, the historians argue that myth was invented while the Hebrew people were in captivity in Babylon, and they were essentially slaves. And the reason why they put that rest day in there was precisely so that they could tell their Babylonian overlords that this was part of their ancient religious traditions and they had to have a day of rest. So this is what we have to thank them for having Sunday. Here we are. We have a day of rest together. Yeah. Cause and effect.
Repercussions on you if the car had crashed. That's not very nice to think about, is it?
Well, it is not. No, you know, and you know, the Rolling Stones did a song about that, and Mick Jagger's doing this monologue, and he said he was driving along the road. I won't try to do the accent, but he's driving along the road, and this man came on the radio and told him that Jesus was looking after me. And I was so pleased to be informed of this, I ran through 7 red lights in his honor. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord. But this is true. I mean, sometimes these things, I mean, they're supposed to be there as a reminder, but sometimes it can be a, you know, it can actually have the exactly the opposite effect than what we're looking for. Yeah. Okay, so if there's no questions right now, we might be at 2 o'clock already. Let's have our first break. Go to the bathroom, have a cup of tea or whatever, and come back. I think what time? 2:30. Half an hour break. Come back at 2:30. Yeah.